opinions expressed by callers, guests, and hosts do not necessarily reflect those of the Black Talk Radio Network and Black Talk Media Project. Black Talk Radio is new black media for the new millennium.
This is Vicki Casanova-Willis with Race Treaty, Black Talk Radio Network. Today actually is May 5th, 2017, Cinco de Mayo, and I wanted to give a shout out and acknowledgement.
Hello, Vicki. We seem to be having some technical issues. Are you there?
Hi, I am here. Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you now.
Great, great. Sorry, this is Vicki Casanova-Willis. I am calling in from Chicago, Illinois, and I'm very, very happy to be able to once again address the audience with Black Talk Radio Network. We're always excited to be a part of the station here. What I was saying just a second ago is that actually I wanted to give an acknowledgement and to honor the fact that this is the 5th of May, 2017, which is Cinco de Mayo. A lot of people misunderstand this as a date in which they think may be Mexican Independence Day, and it's not. That's actually a September 16th date. This actually commemorates the Battle of Puebla, which, again, is just an acknowledgement on this day where people honor the history of resistance against colonial forces. So I wanted to make sure to note that within the last few months, within just this last year, for the very first time, the Mexican government officially acknowledged that there is a group of African descendants within the Mexican community, if you will, excuse me, and basically in recognition of self-determination and the official human rights perspective, which would allow people to have some additional rights and privileges that they can demand as a result of having the sovereign status of African descendants within the Mexican nationality distinction. They've previously not been recognized. So I just wanted to acknowledge that. You hear a little noise in the background, and the reason is that I am coming to you at the end of a very important forum, which actually was today acknowledging and honoring every single first defender in Chicago who, and I'll explain in a second what that means from a human rights perspective, but everyone who has volunteered for 22 plus years to be able to go into the police station upon arrest and basically represent custodial suspects. Why is this so important? It's important because not only is it your constitutional right, but also in human rights law, there are reasons that in light that people can. If you get a chance, please feel free to call. Okay, thank you all for coming. So I'm walking away from well over 100 people who have literally volunteered their time to come in to make real the promise of the Miranda rights, which say you have the right to remain silent, right? Anything you say can and will be used against you. And it always is in a court of law. We actually had the privilege of speaking with the race treaty audience just a few months ago on a historical delegation to be able to take young organizers, attorneys and non-attorneys, who are learning to advance the human rights and the human rights city struggle, to take them from Chicago, from the communities that they're organizing in on the west side and the south side, to just advise people of their rights. And not just constitutional rights, but human rights. So it's just really important to have been here this evening because of some, this was a day when they were literally honoring every single first defender. A member of First Defense Legal Aid is someone who has basically on a pro bono basis agreed to donate some of their time to be able to go into stations and help people invoke their right to remain silent, so that individuals, primarily black and brown, we know from the statistics, and overwhelmingly youth, and all too often more increasingly they are women as well, or trans people of color, and they literally have been able to help begin to interrupt this the false confession, basically tragedy, and the debtor's prison system that is being promoted through these cash bail schemes. And then separately, that really does help in a real sense to begin to push back on this mass incarceration epidemic that we have. So, again, tonight in Chicago, which is an event to honor every single first defender that had ever donated time to be able to go in and represent people who could not afford to have a lawyer, so that they would not have to be alone with only police and prosecutors, which too often ends up with someone confessing to a crime that they did not commit or putting themselves in a position to implicate someone else. And the rest is history, especially here in Chicago. So you'll hear a little bit of noise in the background. I do expect that we will be able to follow up in another week or so to be able to share with the audience the groundbreaking work that has been done now that can potentially have a template for us for human rights cities. So that's part of why I felt like it was really important to be able to share with the race treaty community, and I appreciate you just thinking through when you hear some of these practices, but this does not just mean that it's applicable in the municipality that we're talking about. We need to think about how do we apply this to bring these human rights when home. So, what does it mean to say you're a first offender? Okay, so basically, this is law students and senior law students, as well as lawyers, but also community members. There's a couple different functions, and I'm hoping that, really, really hoping that I don't lose the ability to speak with you right now, because I'm going to make sure that I just touch bases with you and I'm clear so that we don't end up losing the signal. So what I wanted to say is that right now we have a number of people who are not able to represent themselves because they have no expertise in the law, right? These are overwhelmingly young people, black and brown, who, when they are either arrested or sometimes told they're not even under arrest, that they are just being a witness, they're being brought in for questioning. Well, at that point, you actually, by human rights law, if you look at the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, you're able, actually, entitled to have representation. many people cannot afford it. So the simplest thing that we have done here in Chicago is organized a volunteer cadre of lawyers who would be able to represent people in the station. And the importance is that, for example, here there was a huge human rights win that we talked about, which is the John Birch torture situation that had to go all the way to Geneva and then come back home to be able to elevate the breaches of people's constitutional and human rights that were happening through the worst kinds of coercion. Had we had people at the stations to just invoke people's rights to remain silent, many of these confessions would never have happened. Self-confession, which cost people their lives, which cost families their loved ones. So this is what we are combating when we put in place something that, like a first offender. The thing that was so unique that was celebrated this evening is that it is now a possibility for the public defenders to go into the station, which they never were able to do before. So I'll explain to you the difference that that makes. Hold down here. Hi. I'm sorry. Someone is trying to call in to talk with us. I'll urge them to call in if they can later. So what I'm speaking about here is human rights cities. We've talked quite a bit on race treaties about several specific projects or specific initiatives. I want to give to shine a light tonight as well on the incredible victory this week of the people of Jackson, Mississippi, who said once again that they're looking for and believe in a people's government and people's assemblies, and they're looking to truly deliver on a human rights city promises for human beings. So when you hear on race treaty things that are happening in Jackson, Mississippi, or Chicago, Illinois, or New York, or any place in South Carolina or Durham, know that those are practices and principles and policies that you can also apply right at home. So the model for the first offenders is a beautiful thing. I'm not a lawyer. I'm privileged to work with the National Conference of Black Lawyers. I'm also very, very honored to work with First Defense Legal Aid and many other programs that collaborate with both attorneys and non-attorneys to look at international law, which is, the human rights framework, but also just literally look at local and state and municipal and certainly national statutes and policies and understand what it is that needs to to change in order to make something really suitable for humanity. So this is what has happened in Chicago. As I said, we have, I won't say that it's been fixed because it has not, but a tremendous amount of work has been done already to ensure that we can begin to dismantle a racist, oppressive, and completely punitive system, which is called the criminal justice system, but we know that there's no justice in it. It is overwhelmingly impacting black and brown people, especially, and there's no future in that. There's no future for our people, and there's no future for humanity in that situation. When we have more than 80,000 folks who actually did not have any representation when they were under arrest in very coerced situations, when there is international as well as domestic law that they say that says they have a right to it, And when we have a cadre of attorneys and senior law students who have volunteered their time to represent them, then there is no excuse. So what we will call on people to do, just based on the model in Chicago, Illinois, for first defense, we call on you to accept a free legal training. It's a free CLE that actually provides the training that lawyers are required to have to continue their certification, to learn how to advocate for people's Fourth, Fifth, and Sixth Amendment rights at the station so that they can remain silent and not implicate themselves and or confess to something due to the coercion. And then separately, we have webinars, and I'm saying we because I've volunteered for more than a year as an AmeriCorpsista to be able to help support this organization because I saw it literally changing lives. The other aspect of this is that we're urging people to look at the model for, some are calling them rebel cities, and it's across the world, not just in the United States, but worldwide. There are examples of human rights cities which have adopted standards of how to treat their residents and the citizens and or immigrants as just basic human beings that that will include the practice that First Defense provides of, again, mobilizing volunteer lawyers 24/7 so that at the very simplest level, when someone is impacted by the criminal punishment system and arrested, it does not end up in a complete tragedy for them, for their lives. So what we had this, this evening was the Chief Judge, Judge Tim Evans, and I encourage you to Google him. And I also encourage you to support him and other judges or lawyers or educators or politicians or just everyday people, activists. When they do stand up to do the right thing, we know too often they come under attack. Their status quo and their quote-unquote powers that be do not want people to step out on faith and to work together to do what is right. So in this case, we were able to hear from Chief Judge Evans this evening about how important it was for him to know that there literally are people doing the work that inspires him because they demonstrated the work that when he first went to law school is what he felt that he should be doing, which is upholding justice and working for the people. So in this case, we have people from a range of different professional assignments, if you will. There are corporate lawyers. There are what I would call people's lawyers. People may be working as public defenders or in private practice, and yet in their spare time, they are volunteering just 4 hours a month. This shows what a difference you can make, whatever the issue is, whatever the human rights infraction or need is. It does not necessarily take a great deal of time. So I apologize if you're hearing the wind. I'm actually leaving this event this evening, but we did not want to miss the opportunity to share with the Race Treaty audience just how powerful it is to be able to use your skills and combine those with the skills of other people who are looking to bring human rights home. So again, when I talk about what the work that this Chief Judge, the Cook County Board and Board President, the Public Defender's Office in Chicago, what they have recently done working with the First Defense Legal Aid Volunteer or Legal Aid Organization is something that people said could not be done. And that is that public defenders, at least here in Chicago, Illinois, and in most other municipalities, are not able to go into police stations. When someone is arrested, they go through the questioning, the interrogation, and whatever that entails. We know that too often it is something that is nothing nice, and it is not necessarily just interrogation and questioning. You hear that there's a great Chicago L going overhead as I leave this forum. What the public defenders prior to last month in Chicago and most places are able to do is to show up in bail or bond court after someone has already been charged and then represent them later. They've made a confession most times. Many times it's just really too late to do anything. So what we heard this evening and what I knew from all the work and all the news that happened just in the last month, that there was really international and national history made because Chicago, through its chief judge, the Cook County, has ordered access to counsel for everyone immediately upon arrest if they ask for a lawyer. That empowered not just the volunteer attorneys from First Defense, but also now the public defenders who go into the station, and sometimes they're already there, but they just were not able to work with custodial suspects until after the 48 hours, sometimes up to 72 hours. Again, we know from Chicago, statistically, through the torture, Chicago police torture, and John Berg and others, that 72 hours is too long for adults and children to be alone with only police or prosecutors to talk with. So we are really, really excited to see that we have, basically been able to change history and do something that people have said could never be done. And it really was through the work of individuals saying, no, here's what the law says. The law says, the Constitution and the human rights framework says, you have a right to not have arbitrary arrest and detention. I'm speaking of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. A number of the articles speak to exactly what we need to provide for individuals. And we have seen that this is actually possible.
Vicky,
so when it's time for people to figure out, okay, how does this apply to me? We have a model.
Vicky, I have a question.
Understanding. Hi. Mm-hmm.
Hi, this is Sky, your engineer. Greetings to you and the audience. And by the way, if the audience would like to chime in with a question or comment, they can call us at 866-510-9025, 866-510-9025. Hit ** to unmute yourself. Indeed, what you're saying and what you're describing is very positive news and in stark contrast to what we're seeing across the country in many states and many counties where the public defender's offices are being defunded. But it's like you just said, this is access to defense is a human right. So how have you all there in Chicago been able to go against the grain when what I just described is pretty much the norm across the country in defunding public defenders' offices?
Yes, you make a really good point. We were in New Orleans recently as part of this delegation to just both commemorate but also to learn more about what was happening in other municipalities and be able to exchange ideas. I think that it honestly, this is not a, it wasn't a short-term solution, and we're still not there yet. This program is more than 22 years in the making, and it has been through just extremely diligent, extremely focused work of a number of people who refuse to accept that it's, you know, it's okay to treat anyone as less than a person. So the part of what has worked is has been, I would say, first and foremost, the power of people, right? And knowing that every single individual has a role to play. So, for example, the attorneys literally can donate just 4 to 6 hours a month. That's all. It's not asking any one person to, you know, to give up their career or their day job if this does not happen to be the full-time, you know, commitment that they intend to make. But it has been through continuing to communicate, and that's why things like Race Treaty and Black Talk Radio Network, just to be able to inform people about what is going on and what the possibilities might be, is so, so crucial, right? The other piece has been not taking no for an answer. I was laughing with someone this evening because this was really a celebration. It was an annual event to say, you know, to honor people who have worked very hard or done something to advance the struggle. And the ambitious goal this evening was to honor every single first defender, anyone in the last 22 plus years that has taken even a single shift to represent people, custodial suspects. And, you know, several hundred people came together to accept their, you know, medal and to basically hear that if they had not, you know, done what they did through the years, and some of them, maybe it was 5 years ago, you know, the last time they actually were called at 2 p.m. and went to the station to help someone understand what it really means to remain silent and what rights they do have. But just feeling like it is not an option to allow, I would, to answer your question, I think how it has worked is to have a critical mass of people at any given time that feel like it's not an option to say, oh, well, you know, they're not ever going to let us do that. What do you mean, do you post our numbers in the station? They're not going to do that. Or, but we can't, the public defenders are not allowed to go into the station, which is, you know, so to have the vision to say, yeah, but that's just a policy change. Now what do we need to do? How do we need to organize? Who do we need to educate? How do we collaborate to affect the change that we want to see? So I spoke just a minute ago about Jackson, Mississippi, and the great victory that we've seen in part one. You know, we know that they have to, the tremendous sweep that was the Democratic endorsement for Chokwe Antar Lumumba, who really, again, has said when he becomes mayor, the people become mayor. And that's what is taking him to the mayoral victory in June when the final, you know, election is won. So the power of the people is crucial. It also, to answer your question, Scotty, and I appreciate you asking, it also is, I think what I was hearing from people this evening was evidence that everyone has to do their part, right? And that you can learn, you must learn what is happening around the world. And that's the lesson that the human rights framework shares for us. We have these tools and these instruments, and to think that, well, you know, filing the stakeholders report doesn't really matter. So one example is for right now, even though the judge ordered counsel, basically, for everyone under arrest immediately, now, that means that the public defenders for the first time are able to go in and represent custodial suspects. So it immediately expanded the pool of attorneys for not just volunteer attorneys to be able to go in and represent people under arrest, so they would not have to face just prosecutors and police officers in these interrogation rooms under duress, incognito from their families. Many times people don't have any idea where they are, they're terrified, you know, all kinds of things. When you look at these depositions, it's simply unbelievable the things, the length to which people have gone to elicit a statement or a confession from people, whether it's the right person or not, and too often it's not. We see this from DNA evidence, etc. So one of the things that we've learned from this experience and from history is that this is just one more step, right? The battle is not won. There's always an equal and opposite reaction to forces and pushback. So the next step is to say, okay, we got the policy change, and now if the phones are not exponential, the phone calls, right, to the lawyers of the first defense are not increasing exponentially, then, again, the people need to step up and do whatever research is necessary to find out, well, why not? And so that is actually what has happened in the last couple of weeks, and I'm excited to share with the Rape Treaty, you know, audience. And I know that there actually is a website, the Black Talk Radio Network and Race Treaty, that you share the podcast. I appreciate the diligence that you all go through to make sure that the audience is informed and can participate. And we're going to do our job, by the way, to make sure that we're giving even more advance notice and sharing of these conversations that are happening every Friday evening at 8 Central, 9 Eastern, so that even more people begin to join in this movement for... move forward and make some tremendous differences. One of the things I just wanted to share with you is that in the last couple of weeks, the individuals are various people from First Defense Legal Aid, from the Public Defender's Office, and just from the community that is interested in understanding and holding people accountable. They have been doing something called human rights monitoring. So the chief judge, his historic order, so that throughout Cook County, which is not just Chicago, but all the suburbs as well, now the public defenders are empowered and free to go in immediately upon arrest to be able to represent custodial clients. That's huge. It more than doubles the capacity from what First Defense Legal Aid has been providing for the last 22-plus years. You would think that we are in Chicago, which 60 Minutes and others confirmed is the false confession capital of the nation, and thus the world, right? We're in the nation that incarcerates more people than any other nation in the world, sadly. So, and now you have free lawyers, and now you have more than twice the number of free lawyers that you had before, and all this national and international news because of this groundbreaking order that Chief Judge Evans signed, ordering access to counsel upon arrest for everyone who asked for it. You would think that the phones would just blow up, right? That they would ring off the hook. They increased modestly, the calls did, but not to the point that one would expect. So why is that? We haven't stopped arresting people, especially Black people, especially kids, in Chicago and Cook County. No. So a thinking person, and we have many community activists who said, well, we need to find out. So it seems like maybe the people are not seeing the signs in the station that for the last 40 years our statute says should be posted visibly in the station. We should see their right to process, so they have a right to consult with veterans. So what we discovered was that, you know, again, people power. You asked the question of why, when so many cities and municipalities are finding their public defenders who have been historically underfunded, overloaded, rolled back even more, funds being cut. Well, we do know that this is a more challenging time than we have seen in quite some time. Any administration in terms of rules both nationally and things that are being rolled back even locally. But what I will say is that without being deterred by what is today, by looking at what kind of future we want to create, and by really affirming our own humanity, which requires us to look at how we are going to care for ourselves and for each other, that is what the human rights framework is doing. And it is really being applied, not as fully as it will be, but it is definitely being applied in Chicago to the extent that people are saying, okay, I understand that this is the way that it has been. I see that this is the law that's on the book. Let's see what other models there are. That really is what is the difference, is saying, okay, but that doesn't make sense, and this isn't working for us. So maybe that's a policy, then that means we need a policy change. So what do we want to see? What are some of the other models, nationally or internationally, that maybe we can emulate? And if it's not there anywhere else internationally, then, you know, so what do we want to create and how will we go about it? So we have a really, really, I'll say we have a challenging environment. We know that right now.
Vicky, we can't hear. Okay, we have you back.
Hey, yeah, I'm sorry. We just dropped off. And it was the environment that we're in right now is no more challenging than many of our ancestors have faced, right, throughout the centuries. But what we have now that we have not had before is really awareness of some international law that doesn't mean that it only applies internationally. And that's the difference that people are applying here. On the one hand, it's huge. On the other hand, it's very, very small, right? This is just one small area. This is really just looking at first defense opportunities for people under arrest. It has nothing to do. I won't say it has nothing to do, but it doesn't do a great deal to help the environment, right, which is a huge issue that we also need to look at from a human rights framework. It doesn't deal directly with the tremendous attack on education and school closings, although there is certainly a connection with the over-policing and even the cradle-to-prison pipeline, but the way that the schools in particular are used as a conduit to lead certain groups of people into life in prison and, frankly, enslavement, re-enslavement under the mass incarceration system. It doesn't have a lot to do directly with food insecurity and joblessness and, you know, the attack on labor and all that. So in a sense, it's just a small way to fight that, but it provides a model for, again, not being just narrowly focused on, well, this is the way things are here and these are the guidelines and the box that people have been placed in. What it has empowered us to do is to look at an international level to see what the other examples say that we ought to be fighting for. So I would really urge people to look at not just the I-3rd, which certainly Race Treaty lifts up, which is basically the convention and the work to eliminate all forms of racial discrimination. We need to do the work, do the research, see what laws and policies say we are entitled to, and then first and foremost, demand that. And then second of all, let's educate ourselves, right? And then second of all, we need to look at basically what are the things that have not been ratified. We look at that as well. This, the rights of the child, I'm not laughing. I am. Although I'm not in despair, but it's ludicrous that whenever we look at international law and we talk about the issues here in Chicago, for example, with regards to the I don't even know the word to say, but with regards to what is happening with juveniles in the criminal punishment system, for the United States to hold itself up as this beacon of democracy and hope, but to be the only developed, quote-unquote, country that refuses to ratify the treaty that honors and affirms the rights of the child is just absolutely unacceptable. It's unacceptable. And it's would give us a great deal of leverage to feel, especially in terms of the work that is done to disrupt families and to destroy from a spiritual, physical, and mental standpoint, to literally destroy our children at such a young age. So these are things that currently local law is just woefully inadequate in terms of trying to deal with it. So to look at the international framework and understand what has been done anywhere else provides precedent that when you're dealing with the legal system, even here in the U.S., to bring human rights home, it gives some leverage. And so you're hearing, or our listeners are hearing, all kinds of Chicago noises in the background this evening. What I was able to do this evening, and had hoped to do originally, to bring you live from this event convening at John Marshall Law School. And as I said, it was literally just honoring all the individuals who have been able to this point and willing to donate some of their time to just play a small part. And part of what that means is that we have to trust that there is a better future and that there are options that maybe are not in place and enforced today, that if we will simply do our part and model for other people what's possible, but it can create a better future. That, at the very, very minimum, is what we owe our, the next generation, I would say. If we owe ourselves, and we owe humanity. One of the other things I wanted to share this evening, that I loved, actually, when I heard our Chief Judge Tim Evans speaking tonight, when he said not only was it inspirational to him hear from Amy Campanelli, who's the head of the Public Defenders Program here, and, you know, they worked with the union, they worked with, of course, First Defense Legal Aid. Amy even said, you know, that she did not know until Eliza Solovier, who's the current executive director of who I work with, she did not know that the law said since, 1964, that it is a requirement in the state of Illinois that people's rights be posted visibly in every room in the police station. and that is not done. So sometimes it's just, I think the word is watchdogging, right? Sometimes it's literally saying, what laws are on the books right now? Not only the ones what needs to be changed, right, or what laws do we not have that we need to have, but what laws do we have on the books right now that are good guidelines and humane practice that are simply not being respected, and then what needs to happen to make sure that people are held accountable and that those are enforced. And that's where the human rights monitoring comes in. And I know we're only on air for an hour this evening. I look forward to coming back and having time to ensure that people are able to dial in and ask questions and share their own information, because this is really a movement that can help inspire one of the base level asks or policy examples, you know, exemplars for a human rights city. If we can do this in Chicago, we could do it anywhere where, you know, through volunteers. We're not asking anybody for any extra money for anything. Just through volunteers, we're able to staff 24/7 a hotline so that if somebody's arrested, they have a free lawyer. That's what that means. Okay? But that's one example of, you know, being able to look at what any individual can do with just 4 hours or 5 hours of their time any given month, and figuring out how can I apply this to the human rights framework and to help put people move toward more of a human rights cities model. So one way that we could do it is in the criminal punishment system, you know, making sure that we have a human rights city could mean that, you know, you have a whole list of things that at minimum would be met or would be available for people. This is low-hanging fruit. So first defense is a real model that was demonstrated in Chicago at least for 22 years, and there was a lot of pushback can say that, you know, the signs and the phone numbers for these three lawyers have not been posted for all this time. Now there's traction through a lot of community organizing, through a lot of education, and just basic diligence for people to say, you know, this is something that must happen, and here is where in international law and state law and federal law that it is... it should happen. And then we have the model that can also help train, and it could be adapted. We're actually provided, there's webinars that are just free for people to be able to utilize. I wanted to just lift up for you in the last few minutes that we're going to have on the program, I wanted to be able to lift up for you a couple of other things that I heard this evening from some of the you know, the folks who were around who talked about why they give a few hours a month to make sure that this happens. And they were able to talk about having gone to, some of them were lawyers, and they were able to talk about having gone to law school and then come out and, you know, being able to feel like there was such a huge amount of work that needed to be done and that they were not really in position to do it. But that this is this was evident that, especially with the chief judge making a very courageous move to order for the first time, change the status quo and say, you know what, our public defenders are here, and whenever someone is arrested, they need to have access to a lawyer. Maybe new additional resources need to be provided to ensure that, you know, that the paid attorneys that are here all day long are able to cover these cases, but something needs to change. We can no longer have people who are basically coerced into making statements, and then a case is closed, and unfortunately we're finding through DNA evidence and so many other mechanisms that it's a waste of money and it's a waste of time because people are being incarcerated, wrongfully incarcerated. And in the meantime, the crime doesn't dissipate. There have been studies done. I'm trying to share as much information as I can for you right now, and then we want to do some follow-up, even in summits and forums, because we know that the mass incarceration tragedy is just really, it's decimated our community, the Black community especially. It's one that really has genocidal results. So from a human rights perspective and from, you know, the standpoint of humanicide and genocide, if we don't fix this one, this issue, then, you know, most of the other ones probably don't matter. So what we learned this evening, again, is just an example of how individuals, through continuing to educate themselves and educate others, to look at not just constitutional law, or to look at constitutional law, but to also expand on that and look to the international law and to the human rights framework to see what more can be done, what more can be brought to bear to change what is currently happening. And we just continue to work along those lines. The things that I want to list up for you right now, and I think that they are pretty straightforward, is things like the fact that in Paris, public defenders basically sat in, they decided they were not going to continue to have cases come to them with individuals that already had confessions and statements. Because you're looking at a huge load of a workload and lots of cases, but many of them are, you know, unwinnable once you've got a confession or a statement. So they basically decided that they were going to present themselves at the station, and whoever came in, they were going to say that's my client. So there have been cases when attorneys and barristers in other countries have been very, very courageous and proactive about their job, about their work, about their calling and their mission. So to answer Patty's question a little bit earlier, and again, I apologize for all the great Chicago noise in the background. I'm coming back, returning from a forum, the First Defenders Award reception, and really was very, very low-key, but very touching. Thank you to hundreds of individuals who have just donated, literally, free, volunteered some time during their career to be able to, maybe it's just 4 hours a month, maybe they're taking more shifts than that, but to be on call when a call comes into the 24/7 hotline and someone needs an attorney at the station to represent them so that they do not have to be interrogated without a lawyer present. It is a constitutional right, and it's also lifted up several articles in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. We have a really, I want to share a couple of dates with you, so just to think about it. On race treaty for upcoming dates in May, and I want for our listeners to really think about and be aware that this human rights movement is building. We are working very, very hard with individuals with the National Human Rights Cities Alliance and also with the U.S. Human Rights Network and other organizations to ensure that no matter what else happens, that we do our part. And our part is to continue to advance the struggle for human rights right here at home. To no longer just have a small group of people maybe that are aware that international treaties carry the same weight in domestic law as the Constitution. Right? To no longer have people who are so accustomed to, to being ruled out and blocked down or pushed back if they, you know, don't think creatively about what kind of future they want to see. So we are just going to continue to speak with you every Friday at 8 p.m. Central, 9 p.m. Eastern. Many of our programs will be pre-recorded to be able to take advantage of special events or conferences or things that we want you to be able to hear firsthand. Many others on race treaties will be increasingly very, very interactive, and that's totally up to you. And that depends on you calling in to be able to pose questions, to challenge, to ask, to critique, to collaborate, because the human rights framework in international human rights law is just a tool, and a tool is only good if you use it, right? So I'm very, very inspired to be in the presence of people earlier this evening, First Defenders in Chicago being honored for some very historic work. And I don't lift Chicago up like it's perfect. Believe me, just trust me. Too much time with the Chicago police torture drama to think that. I do not lift it up as a model for perfection by any means or as finished work. But I do lift it up as an example of what the power of people, not taking no for an answer and not assuming that, as I hear too often, yeah, but they're never going to do that. Oh, but that's against law. We can't do that. Sometimes it just requires a policy change. And how do policy changes get made? How did the policy get made in the first place? It got made because there were some people who saw that there was a benefit to them for implementing a policy, right? And if that policy is counter to what is correct, if that policy is harmful to any members of our community or other communities, if that policy is counter to the human rights law and framework, then change it.
I'm sorry, Vicki, did you want to close us out?
Yeah, I just want to thank you. You hear the sounds of Chicago, Illinois in the background this evening. It is Cinco de Mayo. One of the things, again, we wanted to acknowledge is that just in the last several months, the Mexican government has for the very first time acknowledged the sovereignty and the unique, distinct African descendant community within the Mexican community, so we honor that today. And then separately, we urge you to take a look at people power and be a part of ensuring that we are building this people-centered human rights movement. One of the things we can do is look to the First Defense Legal Aid model, where volunteer attorneys and senior law students can provide counsel upon arrest, every person that's arrested in the United States. You can do that in your city, in your municipality. We have the model. We will share it with you, adapt it to make it work for you, so that no one has to be funneled into this mass incarceration system through a lack of counsel. It is their constitutional and human right, and we can help make sure that you know how to do that. Thank you so much. We'll talk to you next week on Race Treaty at 8 p.m. Central, 9 Eastern on Friday evening. Google Race Treaty. Dial in, please. Thank you.